Great. Okay, well, thanks for the invitation to come. As many of you, at least in the audience, know, I'm no expert on general relativity and not doing numerical relativity in any serious way. I'm basically a numerical analyst, computational fluid dynamics person who's interested in solving hyperbolic systems of equations that come up in lots of different sorts of applications, and in developing methods and general software that's applicable in a wide variety of areas. And certainly I find numerical relativity to be one very fascinating area where there are lots of challenges. And so it's motivated in part some of the work that one of my students is doing that I'll be describing in part. But we haven't really been doing much with, certainly not with general relativity at all. What I'll describe though is our general approach of what we've been doing in terms of developing these methods and some software for solving general systems of hyperbolic equations on curved grids and to some extent curved manifolds, and describe the methods and a bit about how they work, and I hope they might be useful in the context people here are interested in. So this is an animation of just an acoustics equation being solved on a curved surface in 2D, which is the extent of the applications that I'll talk about in detail here, but I'll try to use this as sort of an illustration of the basic ideas that we're looking at. So this is an acoustic pulse that starts here and is moving across. This is a projection down onto just the XY plane as it goes over this hump. I'll show some more detailed calculations of that later. Look at that. I think I should work okay. This projector is cutting off the left edge of it, but I think it will work okay. So again, sort of an overview of my interests. I've been looking at high-resolution methods for first-order hyperbolic problems that were originally developed for shock waves in Euler equations and gas dynamics, but have been extended to lots of other hyperbolic wave propagation sorts of problems. And in particular, one thing I've been interested in lately is sort of heterogeneous media problems where you have discontinuities in the coefficients. And some of what I'll talk about was kind of motivated by that initially, but also is useful in looking at some of these problems on manifolds. They're Godunov-type methods based on Riemann solutions. If you're not familiar with that terminology, I kind of briefly review what goes on there. And they use second-order correction terms with flux limiters or wave limiters in order to minimize dissipation and dispersion in the numerical methods. Again, I'll kind of briefly go through that. And over the last, 10 years or so now, I've been working on this software package, CLAWPAC, stands for Conservation Laws Package, but applies more generally to hyperbolic problems, and working with various people on different applications of this. You can find the software at this website and some documentation and other information about it, and animations of various results. Currently, we're sort of working on this CLAWMAN version of it for manifolds, which was developed initially by Derek Bale, a student that was working with me on some relativistic problems, and he's the one who really kind of got me interested in this area in the first place. Unfortunately, he's graduated and gone off the industry and doing non-relativistic things, so our direct connection there has kind of disappeared. He was working also with another student, James Ross Maniff, who was interested in geophysics problems on the sphere, and still is. And together, they developed a lot of this sort of general formulation for applying the methods, the type of methods that we've been looking at for curved manifolds. Derek was looking at a particular bit at relativistic flow in the vicinity of a black hole, accretion into a black hole, just the fixed manifold case, Schwarzschild metric in that case. We've also been recently looking at extending this to adaptive mesh refinement. There's a version of this called AMR-CLAW for adaptive mesh refinement that I developed with Marcia Berger, who has been working on adaptive mesh refinement algorithms primarily for the Euler equations for many years, and we've kind of meshed it together with this software so that you can apply it to other hyperbolic systems as well. So the next slide takes a while to come up because it shows some adaptive mesh refinement results just to give an idea of how we're doing things. This is the standard, what's called the Berger-Alliger approach often, of using rectangular grids with patches. So in computational space, we start with some coarse grid. You can see a few cells along the edge. And then there's a region here, most of the grid, that's refined by a factor of 4. And then there's some other patches here that are refined by an additional factor of 4 where the grid lines aren't shown. And this is just at three different times, again, for this problem of this wave going over a hump. So in computational space, where you just have logically rectangular grids, and then those are mapped to a curvilinear grid or a manifold in this case, and some sort of grid adaption criterion is used to determine what part of each grid, what cells need to be refined, and then those are clustered into rectangular patches. So I won't talk too much about that, but the sort of approach that I'll talk about does carry over to this adaptive case, which is often necessary. So what I'll try to do today is very briefly review these Godunov-type methods. I don't want to spend too much time on that, or I won't have time to get to the manifold part, but just go through the notation I'm using, at least the particular version that we used, which we call the wave propagation approach, and then an approach that we developed originally for dealing with discontinuous flux functions, but that is also useful in particular in the manifold case, and also dealing with source terms, and in particular the sort of geometric source terms that arise here. And then I'll talk a bit about curvilinear grids in flat space, just to pick some of the ideas, and then get to the manifold case. And here's sort of an outline of how we're doing things, that we're doing a parallel transport of quantities from cell centers to the edges, re-expressing it in terms of a local orthonormal frame at the interface, and then solving a Riemann problem locally at the interface between grid cells, the flat space Riemann problem locally. And the way that we're doing things, the metric terms and geometric source terms are sort of naturally incorporated in the way that I'll try to describe. There's some papers and students' theses on these web pages here. And also I wanted to mention that the approach that we're using is very much following what was done in this paper on general relativistic hydrodynamics with special relativistic Riemann solvers. It's that sort of approach in this case in particular, and also more generally. Okay, so we're using finite volume methods. If you're not familiar with that terminology, the difference between finite volumes and finite differences basically is that finite differences, you look at sort of pointwise approximations to a solution. I'll use Q for the solution that we're looking for in 1D as a function of x and t, say. Capital Q is the numerical approximation. Rather than looking at pointwise values and finite difference approximations to derivatives, which really sort of assume smoothness, the finite volume method is instead based on viewing Qin as an approximation to a cell average. In 1D, it's just the integral over a grid cell, or in 2D or 3D, integral over the volume. And then using the integral form of the conservation law, that the time derivative of the integral is given by the difference in fluxes at the two edges, or in multi-dimensions by an integral of the flux over the surface, the normal flux over the surface.
Is that the same as finite
element? No. Finite element is sort of a different approach where typically you're looking at the solution as being represented by a linear combination of some basis functions, and typically a variational form of the equations are used to figure out what the right coefficients of the basis functions are. Here, finite volume refers to the fact that we have our grid cells, our volumes, and we're approximating the integral over the volume in terms of the fluxes through the edge of the volume. And in many cases, when you write down the formulas, they end up being indistinguishable from finite difference methods, or even from finite element methods for simple enough problems. But for more complicated problems, they are often different. And in particular, finite volume methods, since we're calculating fluxes at the interfaces, we'll use this idea of a Riemann problem to come up with an approximation to the flux, rather than just doing a differencing of the conserved quantities or something. So this integral form of the conservation law is really the fundamental physical form often, and from that you can derive the conservation law in the differential form if things are smooth. But if things aren't smooth, like you have shock waves, then this is really the more fundamental form. And so one advantage of the finite volume formulation is it's really working with this form and works well for shock waves as well as for smooth solutions. And the sort of classical method of this type is Godunov's method, which dates back to the 50s. Godunov suggested for gas dynamics solving the equations by assuming that the solution is just a piecewise constant function. So in one space dimension and time, at time tn, we just have a piecewise constant function in the grid cells. And then for a hyperbolic equation, as time evolves, these discontinuities in the solution give rise to waves that are traveling at finite speed. And you can construct, you can, if you can solve those Riemann problems, you can, in principle, construct the solution based on that piecewise constant data at the advanced time and average that over the grid cell in order to get the next cell average, and then you repeat that process. And then that can be rewritten typically in terms of differencing a flux. The solution of this, the Riemann problem, is the conservation law together with this piecewise constant initial data, as you would have near one of these cell interfaces. So for the Euler equations, for example, it's the classic shock tube problem of having two constant states with, say, a membrane in between, and then you break the membrane and look at what waves emanate from that. And if you had initially zero velocity anyway, you would get, coming out of the Euler equations, a shock wave moving in one direction and a rarefaction wave in the other, and a contact discontinuity where the two gases are in contact. And in general, for a hyperbolic system, even a nonlinear system like the Euler equations, you have this similarity structure where the solution is a function of x over t alone, and you have basically a set of waves with constant states in between. And numerically, what we do, rather than exactly calculating the structure, is typically use some linearized version of this. Well, there are lots of different approximate Riemann solvers that are used, but one popular one developed by Phil Rowe back in the late 70s is to use a particular linearization, a particular approximation or averaging of the Jacobian matrix based on the flux function that has certain nice properties that I won't go into. But using some approximate Jacobian matrix, you then solve a linear system where the matrix depends on the data on the two sides. And then solution of a linear hyperbolic problem is just waves with finite jumps moving at constant speed. And we use those waves, those jump discontinuities, to build up our solution. So it does a characteristic decomposition of the solution, and that characteristic decomposition is useful in defining both Godunov's method and also higher order accurate versions of it. So at each interface, we have this Riemann problem with these waves moving at finite speeds. And then the update to the cell average in terms of these waves we can look at as being, if we have QIN as the cell average here, the cell average here is the same as the average initially, but it's modified by the jump across these waves multiplied by the fraction of the cell each wave has moved through. So you can, if we split up the jump in Q across each discontinuity as a linear combination of, or as a sum of these waves, sort of the strength of these waves coming out, then the update to the cell average is that each wave gets multiplied by the speed it's moving at, which is just the eigenvalue of A in the linear case, times the time step, delta t, divided by the length of the interval, delta x. And so you can write it in this form as delta t over delta x times the sum of the waves, the right-going waves from over here and the left-going wave from over here in this case. Okay, so this is sort of the fundamental step of solving the Riemann problem, is to take the data in these two cells and split that up as a linear combination of the eigenvectors of A in this linear case, or in the nonlinear case, eigenvectors of some appropriate linearized matrix. And those give you the wave strengths. And then this gives the updating for the first order Godunov method, which is first order upwind method, or just the scalar equation. And so in general, we can look at the cell average as being updated by these quantities, A minus delta Q and A plus delta Q. A plus delta Q coming from the left is the sum of all the right-going waves coming from the left. So S plus means the wave speed, S, the positive part of it. So S if it's positive, or 0 if it's negative. So this just adds up the wave times the speed for all the right-going waves, and wave times the speed for all the left-going waves. And we take the right-going waves from the left boundary and the left-going waves from the right boundary. That gives you the first order Godunov update. And then there's another correction term that's now added in to get better accuracy, which looks like sort of a flux differencing term. And the correction flux takes this form. It's the absolute, it's the sum over all the waves of the absolute value of the wave speed times this quantity times the wave with a tilde over it, which is a limited version of the wave. I won't go into this much, but the idea is that if we just use the wave here, the initial wave, and if it were just a constant coefficient linear problem, then this would just be the second order Lax-Wondroff method, written in a particularly strange looking way where we split it up into the characteristic information, but it would just reduce to Lax-Wondroff. But Lax-Wondroff introduces spurious oscillations near discontinuities, shock waves in particular, and has a lot of dispersion, isn't a very good method numerically. So the idea is that we take these waves and we limit the strength of each wave by looking at how the data in that family is behaving nearby. We compare each wave with a wave from the neighboring Riemann problem in the upwind direction and reduce the strength of the wave if it looks like we're near a discontinuity. And I won't go into that whole theory, but that's been developed in great detail, exactly what approaches are good for applying limiters so that you get much better resolution of discontinuities and you get sharp shocks captured very sharply, but still get essentially second-order accuracy where things are smooth. But for our purposes, the main idea is that if you can solve the Riemann problem and get a set of left and right going waves and their corresponding speeds, then you can plug those into this formula and you have a high resolution method. And it can be applied to any hyperbolic system as long as you know how to solve the Riemann problem, at least approximately, for a set of waves and corresponding speeds. And so that's sort of the basis of the software that we've been developing, is that you have a Riemann solver that splits the data into waves and these, well, the fluctuations are these A plus, A minus delta Q terms. It doesn't even have to be a conservation law. It could be, for example, in propagation in discontinuous media, you sometimes have non-conservative equations, but still hyperbolic, and you still have waves moving in each direction, and you can solve that Riemann problem. And then those can be plugged into this general framework. And then boundary conditions are handled by sort of extending the data to ghost cells, and initial conditions have to be provided. And this is in 1D. In 2D and 3D, I won't go through the algorithms, but it's the same sort of idea, except you need to take care of the multidimensional aspect, but that can be done in a way that you can make it sort of very general for general systems of hyperbolic equations. These are just some of the sort of applications that people I know have been working on, or that we've worked on, or students have worked on, using this general approach, just to give you sort of an idea that these hyperbolic equations arise practically everywhere, and they often mathematically have pretty much the same form, and the same methods can be used. Okay, so one slight difference between what we're doing and some of the more standard approaches, or one variant that we've developed that turns out to be useful for manifolds, is that's what I'll called the F-wave formulation that we'll get to on the next slide, but it was developed for handling general conservation laws originally, where you have a spatially varying flux function. So the function F varies with X. So for example, if you have elasticity or acoustics or something in a heterogeneous medium, then your stress-strain relation varies in space, and so your flux function would vary in space. Or a couple other examples here, but in particular with curved manifolds, we have the metric varying with space, and so we get flux functions that vary spatially. If we look at the Riemann problem for that case, we can generalize the idea of a Riemann problem to looking at having, this is again in space and time in one dimension, having not only arbitrary data, qi minus 1 and qi in the two grid cells, but also having possibly different flux functions describing the problem in the two grid cells. So we have a flux fi minus 1 on the left and a flux fi on the right. And so now the solution, the structure of the Riemann solution is that, again, we'll typically have just waves propagating to the left and the right. If we look at just one side or the other, we just have a standard hyperbolic conservation law, so the solutions will look like waves. But there may also be a discontinuity in the solution at this interface because of the fact that there's a discontinuity in the flux function. And so at the interface, instead of having a single value qi minus a half, we have two different values, the left and the right. But in many problems, what the proper new condition to add is that the flux should be continuous across the interface. This interface acts like a sort of discontinuity moving with speed zero, and so by the Rankine-Hugoniot condition, the jump in flux has to be the speed zero times the jump in Q, and so there's no jump in flux across here. Or another way to look at it is physically, we have to have the flux continuous because whatever's going out of one cell has to be going into the other, or else we'd be getting sort of a delta function singularity growing there. So that suggests that Well, there are two ways to approach this numerically. You could think of solving this general Riemann problem by trying to figure out the strengths of these waves so that they satisfy the appropriate jump conditions for propagating waves in each of these two media, but then also putting in another jump condition for these two states that says there's no jump in flux across there. But a simpler way to kind of accomplish that is to think of decomposing the flux difference, this flux fi evaluated at qi minus this flux fi minus 1 evaluated at qi minus 1, decompose that flux difference as a linear combination of whatever eigenvectors we are using to represent our propagating waves. And so the idea is that we have here a decomposition into the waves that are propagating. We don't have any discontinuity appearing at the interface because the flux is continuous at the interface. So the flux difference has to be described entirely by the jump in fluxes across these propagating waves. So rather than sort of splitting up the jump in Q into waves, if we think of splitting up the jump in F as a linear combination of these eigenvectors, then we, in essence, don't have to worry about the discontinuity here. And so this was the formula I had before, with the sort of standard version was we split up the jump in Q as a linear combination of some eigenvectors that gives the waves, and then the fluctuations were described in terms of those waves and their corresponding speeds, and the second order correction terms look like this. But now instead what we'll do is split up the jump in flux, and the jump in flux dimensionally is like a speed multiplied by the wave. And so if we instead split up the jump in fluxes into waves, which we call Zp now, which are these beta coefficient times the eigenvector, then the fluctuations can be defined just in terms of summing up these F waves over the left-going or the right-going waves. And there's a slight change in the F tilde term. It now just involves the sign of S because the magnitude of S is incorporated into this wave Z. Okay, so I don't want to belabor the details, but the idea is that we're splitting up the jump in flux into eigenvectors. And it turns out that's useful in handling source terms, and we'll see when we look at the manifold case that comes in there too. But the original motivation that we were looking at here was for quasi-steady problems. If you have, say, a one-dimensional conservation law with some source term, there are many problems where you have a near balance between the gradient of the flux and the source term so that dq dt is small, but these two terms individually are large. So for example, if you look at just small-scale motions in the atmosphere or in stellar dynamics, if you have gravity balanced by a hydrostatic pressure gradient, then you have a large source term coming from the gravity, a large term in the flux gradient coming from the derivatives of the pressure, but those two should balance out. And now what you're interested in is small-scale motions relative to that hydrostatic gradient. And trying to capture those can be challenging because of the fact that you have these two large effects that are canceling, and it's down at the level of the difference between those that you're trying to model things. This also comes up, say, in looking at shallow water equations. If you're studying just water in a lake, say, that's essentially stationary, but you have some bottom topography, then the bottom topography gives a source term that also essentially cancels out with a hydrostatic term. So one standard approach to solve problems with source terms is to reduce it to simpler equations by using a fractional step method where you alternate between solving the homogeneous conservation law, ignoring the source term, and then taking a time step with just the source term, which reduces it to the problem of the conservation law, and then just an ODE typically for the source term. But if you alternate back and forth between this, that works quite well actually for a lot of problems, but in this sort of quasi-steady case where each of these causes a big change in the solution, one causes a big change and the other should change it back pretty much, you're using very different methods for these two problems, and things won't cancel out exactly right, and the small-scale motions you're trying to capture will typically be lost in that noise. So this often doesn't work for these sort of quasi-steady problems, or at least it doesn't give nearly as good accuracy as you'd like to. So another way you can look at doing that is to look at, again, generalizing the Riemann problem to include this source term. And so if we think of this source term, this psi of q, as being split up as a sum of delta functions at the grid interfaces, the xi minus a half, with strength delta x times some psi, capital psi x, at xi minus a half, then the Riemann problem here consists of, well, it could be in general different flux functions or the same flux function, but we also have a source term, a sort of delta function source term now that's concentrated right at the interface. Then in that case, we no longer have the flux being continuous across here. Instead, there's a jump in the flux across here which balances this delta function singularity. And so the jump in flux across the interface is equal to delta x times the source term, this concentrated source term at I minus a half. So what that suggests is that we modify the algorithm by taking the jump in the flux minus delta x times the source term and split that up as a linear combination of the eigenvectors that are supposed to represent these propagating waves. Okay, and then we just use those waves in the previous algorithm. So we now forget about the source term and we just apply the usual algorithm here. And the nice thing about that in the context of this quasi-steady problem is that if you're really in a steady state, then the jump in f divided by delta x should equal the source term. You have that cancellation, or approximately. And so if that's true numerically, that the jump in f divided by delta x equals the source term, then the left-hand side here is equal to 0. And we're splitting up 0 vector into these waves, and so we make no change to the solution. Or if we're almost in balance, these things almost cancel out, then it's the deviation from that steady state that we're splitting up into waves, and we're applying these second-order correction terms and the limiters and so on to those small waves, which really represent the small-scale motions relative to the steady state. So we're kind of subtracting out the steady state and just applying all the high-resolution method to the deviation from steady state, which is exactly what we want to do. Okay, so in general, this is a kind of a useful technique for dealing with these quasi-steady problems, but we'll also see that this idea comes into the algorithm we're using for the manifolds for handling the source terms that arise from the manifold geometry. Okay, so now let's look at the multidimensional case. Maybe I should ask, are there any questions about sort of the one-dimensional ideas before I go on? Again, we'll see sort of how those come in as we go on. Okay, so in two dimensions, say, we have the time derivative of the integral of q over some finite volume is given by the integral of the normal flux around the boundary. And again, if q is smooth, we can reduce that to just the two-dimensional conservation law. But this, again, is really the more fundamental physical law, and that's what we mimic with the finite volume methods. So on a two-dimensional this Cartesian grid, our Qijn would represent the cell average over one grid cell, and we would update that by approximating the integral of the flux along the four edges of that, which ends up giving this sort of flux differencing formula, where these Fs are approximations of these integrals of the flux. So the simplest sort of method based on the idea of Godunov's method in this context would be that at each interface, we solve a Riemann problem in the normal direction. So at this interface, we're looking at just qt plus fx equals 0. At this interface, we're looking at qt plus gdy equals 0. And we define the flux to be the flux f evaluated at this q Riemann problem. This is supposed to represent the solution of the Riemann problem based on the data qij and qi plus 1j. This isn't a particularly good method. It's only first-order accurate. It's not incorporating sort of any multidimensional information. It can be extended to these high-resolution methods to give good results in 2D. But for the purposes of this talk, these are the ideas that we need, that basically the main component is solving a Riemann problem normal to the interface. And that gives us a set of waves and speeds. And then we can do various things with those to get a second-order high-resolution method out of it. OK, so if we look at just flat space, if we have now a curvilinear grid instead of just a Cartesian grid, then the way we think of things is that computationally we're working on a rectangular grid, but this represents some curvilinear grid physically. And there are two possible approaches you could think of. One would be to take the equations over here in physical space, transform them into equations on this rectangular computational grid, and then just look at those as being a set of partial differential equations, discretize those, and solve that here, and kind of forget about the physical space at that point. And that can be quite successful, but the equations, once you transform them over here, include these metric terms and source terms from the geometry. And especially for problems that involve shocks, you have to be a bit careful about how you handle those, or you can run into problems just kind of discretizing that set of equations here. The other approach, which is the one we follow, is really to think more of the data as being here in physical space and update cell averages on these finite volumes by solving Riemann problems normal to the edges and computing the appropriate integral of the flux around the boundary, which I'll describe more in a couple slides. So as an example, I'll just use this linear acoustics in, well, I guess it could be any number of dimensions, but basically thinking of just the surface, two-dimensional surface in three space, say, in a homogeneous medium. So we have, say, constant density and bulk modulus, so constant sound speed. P is the pressure, U the velocity, T the stress tensor, which is just P times I. And so we get these equations on a general manifold with H being the determinant of the metric tensor. Here they are again. So the first approach would be to just take this as a set of PDEs and discretize these equations on the computational grid. But we have these spatially varying flux functions here, and we also have this source term here. This is the scalar component, the pressure. So it doesn't have a source term, but the tensor component, the velocity, has the source term because the basis is changing. And so if we just discretize this term and this term separately, it's not clear, for example, that we really have a conservative method, even though in this flat curvilinear grid, we should still have conservation. But we may lose that if we handle the source term separately from here. And again, there are other potential problems with this. So the approach that we used instead, which is widely used, is to think of storing the solution at conserved quantities in these physical grid cells. And on a flat space, at least, we can think of maintaining the velocity components just in terms of Cartesian components U and V. You can't do that on a general manifold, but at least in flat space, you can do that. And so at each cell edge, we can just take this data we have on each side, compute from the U and V velocities, the velocity normal and tangential to the edge. And once you have that, you can just look locally at solving a Riemann problem normal to each edge. That gives you some waves propagating away from the edge. And then use those waves to update the cell average. Now, to update that cell average, you have to look at how that wave, as it moves into the cell, how does that affect the cell average? Well, it's going to be sort of the area covered by that wave divided by the total area of the cell. So we're going to be sort of scaling that wave strength by the length of this side and by the distance it moves in, the speed times delta t, and then dividing by the physical cell average. And of course, when we do that, what we're really approximating is just the covariant derivative that comes up into the formulation on the Cartesian grid, because the lengths of the sides are just the diagonal terms in the metric tensor times the computational cell lengths, and the area is the square root of h times delta x1, delta x2. And so we can look at this as being a particular discretization of the equations that we have in computational space, if we moved it over there. But it's being done in a way where, rather than sort of approximating these by, say, computing this term at the cell center, we're instead actually computing physically the area of this cell as a quadrilateral, and we're computing the lengths of these sides, and so we're maintaining exact conservation physically in the physical space. Okay, so this is just an example on flat space of just shallow water equations flow around the cylinder, but computed with two different grids to make the point that one advantage of sort of doing things physically, I think, is that you can handle much more general grids without having to worry about non-smoothness or non-orthogonality or other features of the grid. So this is just a nice polar coordinate type grid for flow around the cylinder. The solution at two different times, there was a shock wave that hits the cylinder and you get a bow shock and transmitted shock going past. This was on a grid that doesn't come out too well here, but it's a grid that is mapping the circle out to this square. And so along the 45 degree lines, there's sort of a 90 degree change in the coordinate direction as we go around. We were using just a grid that goes around like this computationally. We wrap it around and then periodic boundary conditions at the edges. And it's not orthogonal the way this one is, and it has these discontinuities in the metric terms, and yet we get essentially the same results on that grid. You can see along the 45 degree line there's a little bit of noise there, but essentially we're getting the same sorts of results. And again, the high resolution methods are used to get sharp capturing of these shock waves. Okay, so now if we go to a manifold, now our patch of computational cells is mapped to some set of cells on the surface of this manifold. And so now we do have to represent the velocity in terms of sort of the basis vectors that were given on the computational grid. But we can still do a lot of the same sorts of things that we were doing in the curvilinear grid part. We now have to, instead of just having the Cartesian coordinates of velocity and from those computing the normal velocity, instead we have to take the velocities we have in each grid cell and parallel transport them to the cell edge in order to get velocities at the cell edge and from the two sides that are in a consistent coordinate system. And then we change coordinates to a orthogonal frame, orthonormal frame, so that we have normal and tangential velocities of, or normal and tangential components of the velocity at the edge. And then we solve basically a flat space one-dimensional Riemann problem normal to the cell edge using that data. And then once we have those waves, we again scale them by the length of the side and transform them back to cell-centered coordinates and propagate them into the cells on either side in order to update the cell average. So it's basically the same sort of flavor as on a curvilinear grid, except that we have this additional term, additional step of the parallel transport. So the software currently, it's only in two space dimensions, although in principle it could be extended to more. But it, again, the idea is we're trying to make it as general as possible, so the user only has to provide, in this case, just a 2x2 metric tensor. And that's used to compute these scale factors, the volumes of the cells, the lengths of the edges, and also in doing the orthonormalization. And then we just call this routine to estimate Christoffel symbols by finite differencing that metric tensor. Those are needed for the parallel transport step. So that's shown here to take the data that we have in the cell centers in terms of the coordinate system there and map them to the interface from the left and the right. We're basically just using a Taylor series approximation that the mth component of the velocity, xk, represents, say, the center of a cell. Xk plus or minus a half delta xk, k is the coordinate direction, represents the cell edges to the left and the right. And using this expression and just the first term in the Taylor series, we just approximate that by the value at the cell center, minus or plus a half delta xk times gamma nkm times um xk, summed down n and k, of course. And we do the same thing. This is just to show that for acoustics, where we have a scalar field and this vector field, that we're applying the parallel transport to the vector components. Okay. Now we do the same thing to the flux functions, and in fact we use this sort of F wave formulation, so it's really the jump in flux that we're splitting up into waves. So we take the jump in flux at the cell edge if Fij is the flux evaluated in cell ij, then we transport that to the cell edge. Fi minus 1j from the neighboring cell also gets transported to the cell edge. And then it's that jump in flux that we want to split up into waves. Well, if we look at this and rearrange it, we have the jump in flux minus delta x1 times what I'll call psi 1 I minus a half j, which is exactly these remaining terms here. Whoops, this, yeah, I guess that's right. Something got cut off there. And that's really just the n equals 1 portion of the source term that comes into the acoustics equations when written that on the manifold. And so we can look at doing the parallel transport, applying it to the jump in F is, in essence, automatically incorporating the source term into the Riemann solution, which, of course, is natural. That's exactly where this term arises from, is from the parallel transport in this way. But the point is that by doing it computationally this way, we're sort of using the physical basis of those equations rather than trying to discretize the source term separately and have it balance out our discretization of the hyperbolic part. We're instead handling the hyperbolic part in a way that naturally incorporates the source term, the geometric source terms, as part of the Riemann solution, which is really sort of where it should be coming from anyway. Okay, so it's again these terms that are coming in through that. So just to summarize with this formulation, the source terms are automatically incorporated by this parallel transport of the fluxes, so we don't handle this term explicitly at all. And these covariant divergences here are handled by the fact that we're computing the lengths of the edges of the cells and the cell volume explicitly, and doing the flux differencing and dividing by the cell areas is exactly calculating these sorts of terms. And once we've done this parallel transport and orthonormalization at the edges, then we apply just the standard flat space Riemann solver, one-dimensional Riemann solver, at the edge in order to actually compute the waves. And I just wanted to show one other example. This is the example that James Ross Manuth was looking at of flow on a sphere, just to show that this sort of approach can handle non-smoothness in the metric, also in the manifold case. This is what's sometimes called the cube sphere grid. Of course, latitude, longitude are natural coordinates to use on a sphere, but have the problem that at the poles, you have all these grid lines coming together, and therefore very small grid cells and typically numerical difficulties. So another popular approach is this cube sphere, where you think of sort of taking a cube, putting a grid on each of the six sides, and then inflating it out to a sphere. And so you have much nicer grid cells that are nearly uniform in size. But you have these corner points where these grids come together, and although typically you have four cells coming together at each point, at these points there are only three grid cells coming together. But that can be handled by essentially solving the equations on each patch separately as a single rectangular grid, and passing data back and forth between these patches by using ghost cells on each of the patches to copy over data from the neighboring patches.
And here you have overlapping.
Well, it's only the ghost cells that overlap the neighbors.
Right.
And so in each time step, we would take the data we have in these red cells, say, and put them into the ghost cells for the yellow grid. And
yeah,
similarly
is there
edges.
Anything preventing you from just doing touching grids?
Well, essentially, you're trying to do touching grids, but the idea is that when you're updating one of these yellow cells, you need the data from a red cell in order to, say, solve the Riemann problem between these two cells. So you could take that data explicitly from this grid, but computationally it's more efficient to think of first taking some of the data and copying it into ghost cells, and then simply applying the algorithm on this slightly expanded patch. That's sort of the way that we handle boundary conditions in general.
One comment was, you may be thinking about something like the kind of signal projection that you can do if you take stereographic projections.
No, actually,
you can do something exactly that looks exactly like that, except that in that case you actually do have overlap.
No, what I'm thinking is something else. It's a body of work trying to, this for the cost and coefficient case of hyperbolic problem, where you try to find a discrete energy estimate for the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So there, a key point is to use touching grid, not
right,
overlapping.
Right.
There you lose
yeah.
control.
Well, they're not, I mean, they are touching in that sense, in that at every time step we have a single, I mean, we have approximations to the solutions only on one grid or the other grid. And the ghost cells are only used as a computational convenience to take the data from one cell and pass it to the other cell in terms of what we need from the neighboring grid cells. But at each time, we really only have a unique value of the solution at any point, so they are touching grids in that sense. Okay, so on this grid, as just one simple example, looked at various other things, but one example that sort of illustrates that these methods perform reasonably, what we looked at should come up in a moment here is a shallow water equations, which are often used for just modeling the atmosphere, for example, or at least as an initial test problem for the atmosphere. We looked at shallow water equations with discontinuous data. So the water depth jumping from some low value up to value 1 here, this is as a function of latitude from the North Pole to the South Pole. So it was symmetric around the sphere, so the deep water near the North Pole, shallower water everywhere else, and then you let it go and you get a shock wave that moves southward all the way around, but it's cylindrically symmetric around the sphere, and so you can plot the solution as a function of latitude, and the red circles here are just a scatter plot of all the data from everywhere on the sphere from these 6 grids, with each value plotted as a function of the latitude. And at the initial time, of course, they all lie on this black line, which is just the true solution that we're trying to compute. So what you can do then is at later times also look at this sort of scatter plot of the solution, and should come up in a minute here. The black line in each case will be the true solution as computed solving a 1D equation with the appropriate transformation for the sort of symmetric case. So at time 1.25, we've got this has given a shock wave that's moving southwards here, followed by a rarefaction wave. And the black line, again, is a very fine grid solution from a 1D calculation. And the red circles that cover it are just the scatter plot of all the data from the sphere at this time and at some later time as this shock is, actually, I think the shock has at this point already sort of bounced off the South Pole or gone through the South Pole and is moving northward again. And the point here is that you're getting good resolution of the shock wave and that it's pretty much isotropic around the sphere, even though these grids, again, have these points where the direction of the coordinate lines changes and these corner points where you might expect potentially numerical difficulties, but you don't really see any glitches coming from that at all. So that's it. This is just the outline from the beginning and to kind of remind you what we looked at, but that's all I have.
Questions?
Can you explain again how do you handle the source term in the manifold?
Within the parallel transport?
Yeah.
Sir?
I don't think you've got that.
What do you call parallel transport? It's not very clear.
Let's see. This one? Yeah, so the U is the velocity, and this was again for the acoustics case. So U is the velocity represented in the local coordinates. So this is the velocity, U at xk, um of xk, and in the kth coordinate direction is the mth component of the velocity represented in contravariant form at the cell center, say, and delta xk is the width of the grid cell in computational space in the kth coordinate direction. And so from the values of the velocity in contravariant form at the grid center, we want to approximate the velocity, the mth component, in terms of the local basis that we have at the interface xk plus a half delta xk or xk minus a half delta xk to one side or another. And that's approximated just by using this equation in a Taylor series.
What's the Why is the philosophy covariantly constant? Is that one of the field equations you're trying to solve for?
Yeah, so probably it's an example before this where you had a discussion.
What the?
Well, somehow you were trying to have the source term to the right, say this one. So in the second line, okay, you have the evolution of the velocity field equal has two terms. You have the source and the second term there.
That's just a convergence.
But in the steady case, it just cancel out, and then you.
T is the stress tensor. It just pressure times the identity matrix in this case.
Right, so how do you handle this particular equation?
Right, so let's see that. I think the.
Let's say the yield derivative is
the solved.
Maybe it's clear on this one. So the scalar component is simply.
So the goal was somehow to take those two terms in a way that if they had to cancel, they would cancel in a much better way than just taking them independently from each other.
Right.
That you combine the two.
Right. So, so this is sort of the parallel transport step for the, if Q represents the pressure and the velocity for the acoustics problem, then the pressure, being a scalar, is just the same, but the velocity has to be represented in terms of the local coordinates at the interface, and that is what this matrix should be doing. And then we apply the same thing to the flux functions, so it's really the flux functions that are being transported now to the boundary by exactly those same matrices. But if you rearrange that, we've got I times F here and I times F here, which gives the flux difference. But then we also have this matrix and this matrix multiplied by the flux function. So that's what's put into the source term. But that is an approximation to exactly the source term that comes into the equations. And I mean, that's basically where the source term arises from the.
Well, so you have an equation with gamma depends on Q, which is the variable that you are trying to solve for?
Yeah, so I mean, if you're thinking of GR, then it becomes more complicated in that sense. And we haven't really worked through the implications of to what extent this applies in that case. So this would be more for just relativistic flow, relativistic hydrodynamics, say, on a fixed space-time.
Thermodynamics, you do have exactly the same equations. When you write it, so it doesn't depend on your state vector, basically on your U. It just depends on the space-time, background space-time. Mm-hmm. So the problem doesn't arise.
If
you try to solve this numerically, yeah, and you have your right hand side, that gamma there at a given time is the background space time. Uh-huh. So, right. I mean, that doesn't depend on.
Right, so you were thinking, at least certainly for the example I'm looking at, this gamma is fixed.
Yes,
yes.
Okay.
It's
talking about, you know, it
varies with space, but not with Q at all.
The conservative form of the argument.
But I mean, the zeroth order question is. Request that you guys use a numerical algebra, the vacuum equations. Do you have anything which looks like algebraic models?
You could write.
No, is it really conservation model? There's no extra term left over.
No, yeah, there is.
Right.
So you can also have sources.
Right. But that's all. Right, exactly. So therefore, and these sources depend again on the dynamical variable itself, right? So I would like to understand.
My comment was referred to the idle part only. If you're talking about the fields, then I agree. Then it's a mess. Yeah.
Isn't it the case that you're really trying to go to a local orthogonal plane at the edge of the cell?
Right.
So you're basically trying to pull the covariant transformation into the finite difference scheme that we use as well. That's fine and both. So basically trying to recall the transformation to a local orthonormal frame that was basically the basic idea.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically the right to put everything into an orthonormal frame at the edge in such a way that you can solve just a flat space or a local special relativistic Riemann solver in that case. Right. Right.
Any other questions? Great. Thank you.